FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. Today is March 28th, 2017. Quarter is winding down. So, three steps and a stumble. Does it still apply? Have the markets outgrown it? Well, it's an old rule, almost an old maxim of Wall Street. And Danielle Park is here to opine. Welcome back, Danielle. Hope you're feeling a little better now.
It's coming.
Yeah, well, you're still in winter up there in the north, and we're getting into summer here in the south.
Yeah, well, it's spring for sure. There's hardly any snow anywhere, and everything's covered in sand and dirt. So,
sand and dirt, which
salt
means
and dirt. I mean, salt and sand. Yeah.
Yeah, it's time to clean up, the spring cleanup, right?
Yeah, looking forward to it.
And maybe the markets are finally going to do a spring cleanup of their own.
Who knows? We're in such bizarre territory in so many of the metrics, which have been reliable historically, that it's very difficult to know. Just basically, you're looking at Fed hikes that have already, you know, they've already gone, and they're in the midst of what they anticipate being another two or three hikes this year. They've been talking about balance sheet normalization, as you know, in the U.S. Fed, which is, you know, I no doubt they're interested in that. That means they need to offload somehow some, you know, $4 trillion of mortgage-backed securities and loans that they swapped off your banks since 2008 to give credit or give cash into the system. So I have no doubt that the central banks are very committed and focused this late into this cycle of trying to back out of emergency policies. And the question is this time going to be different than other cycles? Because you were mentioning about the adage, was it three steps and a stumble, that was typically used to express the reality that once central banks begin into a hiking cycle, you typically do get a pullback in stock markets. Actually, I was writing about that this month in our client letter. And since 1965, the fact is that every time that the central bank has been already into a hiking cycle, you know, a couple of steps in, have already hiked a couple of times, and you get the S&P 500 at a new cycle, a high. When you couple those two things, thereafter, we had a bear market in the range of 27 to 56% declines every single time since 1965, except for one. And you guessed it, it was in the 3 years before the NASDAQ peak in 2000. So in 96, the S&P hit a cycle high and they'd already begun their hiking cycle. And the NASDAQ didn't peak until March of 2000 before it fell 80%. So you could say that that was an anomaly perhaps that time, but the downside effect ended up being, you know, the worst since 1929. So it's interesting. I think we should watch this very carefully because we know that the stock market has so far overshot any kind of rational connection to earnings or wages or growth prospects. It's just basically waiting for an excuse to have another bear market. It's certainly overdue. It's certainly every indicator suggests that it should be the next thing up. So we have to kind of see how this goes.
And yeah, it's interesting. So we look at our conventional measures of value and we see that they have no bearing whatsoever, which tells you that the market is kind of in uncharted territory valuation wise. So then you have to look at other explanations for that and the inability to make a return elsewhere in the economy, right? There is no, you can't put it into bonds because you get nothing. Your CDs, bank accounts pay you nothing. And you go on and on. Real estate, yeah, you can make a return, but it's illiquid. And you just go down the list. And that's a large reason. And then you have instability in Europe, both in Europe, in the euro, the currency itself, and the European banks. And so obviously there's been some light to quote unquote safety to the U.S. So these things have definitely helped beat it. And then you've got central banks buying stocks. Has that ever happened in our lifetimes before, Danielle?
You know, not officially. Not officially, perhaps. I mean, it's certainly been happening in Japan for quite a while now. But, you know, they're at a point where the Japanese central bank owns more than 40% of the government treasury bills over there. So they have a total disaster on their hands because the pensions and insurance companies that need these products to match with their liabilities are not able to get them or holding on to them, don't want to part with them or sell them because there's just not enough supply on the market. Such a total disaster for the real economy, for, you know, any productive financial pursuits that need to go on in the free world. You know, they basically, here's the problem. You know, you can say, okay, we're in this brave new world, and so none of the financial metrics matter. So my entire training of years of learning how to become a financial analyst is all, you know, completely irrelevant in this environment. You can say, well, you know, you're wrong because the prices have gone up. So the fact that your math says that they're not good investments, you're wrong. And I would just simply counter with that doesn't make the assessment of them as poor investment prospects wrong. It makes the fact that we have a highly speculative environment certainly driving the bus here, but it doesn't mean that someone who's trained to actually do math and knows how to assess whether you're getting a fair price for future cash flows, for example, there is math involved in that, right? To figure out whether it's a high probability of positive reward or not. It's not a crapshoot. It's not a flip a coin. It's a longstanding way that we assess these things in the real world. And so the fact that the metrics, you know, I've been in this business a long time now. I've seen these manic cycles more often than I ought to have, given, you know, I've been at this just over 20 years, but we've been in this period of secular, what I call the secular bear market since 2000, you know, since the late 90s, essentially, basically the central bank decided to support all the banks at all costs to bail out their risk-taking. Long-term capital blew up in 1998. You know, Greenspan and company stepped in. They rescued it. The memo was clear to Wall Street and all the risk-takers in the world. You know, you guys go. Don't worry. We've got your back. If you blow up, we're going to make you whole. And that whole mosh pit just became driving the entire, all the decisions, all the policy, you know, rate hike decisions. All of a sudden, it was all about, you know, trying to placate markets, this crazy manic thing. And so here we are today. You know, I'll give you an example. Maybe there's parts of your country where real estate is still a positive cash flow as an investment, as an example, that you can still buy properties in some regions for a decent amount of money where rents still more than cover the upkeep, maintenance, mortgage payment, taxes, yeah, all that. But in Canada, that is rarely the case today. In fact, if we look at the numbers, since 2014, there's been a massive jump in the amount of people buying properties, which they say are, quote, investments. So not to live in, but as investments. But in fact, when you look at the math in all those regions, they produce negative carry. So this is the very definition of speculation, right? This is an asset which you're buying, which will take your cash flow to maintain it. So this is the opposite of paying you an income. You're actually paying it to keep it afloat while you're holding it. Why in the world would anyone do that? Well, they do that only when they assume prices are going to go up more than your negative carry in the interim. And that's the definition of speculation. And that's the what's been driving, you know, at the margins of these markets. And this is far from just Toronto and Vancouver. I can tell you, we live an hour north of Toronto, and the properties in this area have been jumping 30 to 60% in just the last year. And this is a relatively small town. That's and this story is all across the country. We know that Canadians are the highest indebtedness they've ever had, 170% debt to household income or disposable income, far surpassing you guys at the height of your madness in 2006. I think you got to about 130% debt to disposable income. So we're way past that. And you know, here's the thing that I keep going back to. We have a population that is aging you know, day after day, more elderly people, less people paying into pots of money and programs and, you know, benefits and all these things, and more people taking out, less time to recoup losses when we get into the next bear market. And we've got pensions that are facing the largest deficits they've had to date, Carrie. So if this Bubblenomics was actually serving or doing anything other than papering over holes for a while before it all falls apart again, you know, we wouldn't have this huge savings deficit in all the things that matter. So we're at a massive inflection point again in another debt bubble episode. And, you know, there's only one way for debt bubbles to resolve themselves, and that's typically in a burst or a sideways deflation, although that's extremely rare. But you could say, well, maybe prices don't have to go down, maybe they just won't go up for a while, to which I would say, okay, so like 15 to 20 years of sideways stagnant would be sort of required in order to mean revert the excess we're seeing here. And then in the meantime, who's paying the bills, right? Who's gonna put the inflows necessary to maintain all these negative cash flows when governments, I mean, your government debt's doubled since the last downturn. If you look at your key sectors, you know, healthcare, the debt in healthcare in America, is that sector has added 308% increase in debt of those companies. Technology debt up 332%. The automotive sector, which has been a big growth driver, so to speak, in the US since 2009. I mean, you're off the charts, wacko, extend and pretend, negative equity. You know, your used car prices are all falling because all these leases are coming off and flooding the market with used product. So this is impacting the finance companies again, because they have factored in, you know, these end term values that determine what their profit on these leases are. And, you know, your car prices have come down something like 14% in the last 2 years. So this is obviously impacting these leases as they roll off. So it's been a disastrous approach. It doesn't mean math doesn't matter anymore. It doesn't mean that investment metrics are irrelevant. It just means we've been in an episode of financial mania, which has rarely ever seen precedent of this scale. In fact, I would submit this is probably the biggest one ever. And we've had successively larger manias in the past 17 years, but I think this one has truly been the most ubiquitous. It's affected every sector and every asset, and it has made the whole thing more indebted than ever before.
Yeah, and I'm not advocating for a gold standard by any stretch. It's never going to happen, so I'm not wasting my breath. But when we did have sound money, at least then, you could only have one bubble at a time. You didn't have multiple bubbles getting blown in the stock market, in student loans. I mean, they didn't have student loans back then. But, I mean, you only could have one at a time, whether it was stock market or real estate. You didn't have a stock market bubble and a real estate bubble. So all of this.
And a corporate debt bubble.
Yeah, and a corporate debt bubble and a government bond bubble. Yep, all of this is a function of funny money. Right.
Here's a question for you. How much do you think it would take in a bear market correction, let's say, to return the S&P, which is the best performing market in the world since 2009, because of all the Fed led, you know, inflows, cash and hype that basically went on? The S&P performed the best of all these indices in the world. What do you think it would take to return the S&P today from these all-time highs to where it was at the last cycle peak nearly 9 years ago?
I think it's 60%, but don't quote me on it.
30%. Just a 30% bear market decline would take the S&P back to where it was in December of 2007. And here's the kicker for the Canadian market. You'll remember from 2003 to 2008, and there was a massive all Canada, all love. You know, we were the star turn because we were the commodities producer. Yep. And everyone was madly in love with Canada. And they took Mark Carney and put him into the International Forum for looking over banks. And then he went to the UK and all that good stuff from the Bank of Canada. Well, here's the thing. Guess what it would do? What would we have to lose in Canada to take us back to where we were in the peak of the last cycle?
You got me.
Less than 2%. And indeed, if we have a run-of-the-mill bear market decline, that regular 30% kind of style that we've seen repeatedly through history, the Canadian market would be back where it was 17 years ago. So this is what I mean. All this sound and fury and throwing debt and throwing credit and expanding and throwing away all the prudent investment rules just creates this mess of extreme overvaluation crash, extreme overvaluation crash. And ultimately, you're no farther ahead. You have more debt. The values mean revert. All that paper wealth that you thought you had evaporates because nobody, you know, very few people are cashing out at those levels. Mostly it becomes this scramble to get in at those levels, you know, and a lot of the people are trying to buy multiple properties. Like last 2 weeks ago, we had in Toronto, the real estate expo. Okay. This was a fiasco of, incredible proportions, Carrie. It reminded me of the tech bubble, tech boom, how to become a millionaire in tech stocks in 2000, how to become a millionaire in commodity stocks in 2008 style conferences that were running. Now, this one was led by people like from the Home and Garden Television and, Tony Robbins came up
flippers.
To do the house flippers extraordinaire. The rehabbers, and there was a firsthand, I didn't attend it because I couldn't stomach it, but a friend of mine was there who's a realtor and another person did a firsthand account that they wrote called I Attend the Top of the Canadian Housing Market So You Didn't Have To. But this is, people have to read this. This is a character type that is prevalent in these manic phases where the whole thing is about get in any way you can. Borrow money off your cousin, your aunt, your neighbor, buddy. If you've each got $100 at work, throw it in, get in. The extent of the intellectual discourse that goes on at these so-called guru events. And it's a total disaster because, little people are being sucked in right at the top. Just like, for example, right now, if you look at your fund flow data, ETFs and passive funds have attracted the retail investor again in the past, since Trump was elected, basically the greatest flows we've seen since other cycle peaks. So these are people who ultimately have lost, lost in 2001, two, lost in 2008-9, stayed away for a long time licking their wounds. And then recently, whatever cash is available, they've said, okay, fine, I'll go back in. And this is all classic top formation stuff. So, how long will this go on? Who knows? But what's driving the world right now is the currency flows. The U.S. dollar has been, increasing against the basket of world currencies. It's up 40% since 2008 against the main currencies. With the promise of further hikes coming from your central bank, with the Scottish just voted for another referendum today. Did you catch that on leaving So they want to be separate. So you've got the pound getting pummeled. You've got the euro getting pummeled. Now that's actually been good for exports in the past few months. So that's what they needed is they needed a decelerating currency after years of it being in a bubble. So you've got the pound and the euro falling and that's helping those economies because they're dependent on exports. But everything else, is weakening. And we've hit, peak craziness in terms of consumption of goods and use of credit. So from here, it's very unclear what more can be done by any sort of central bank other than more QE. But as I said, that's already run into like madness squared and the banks are complaining and all the financial intermediaries are complaining they can't run portfolios or manage, anything that they're supposed to be doing here with no decent product available and no decent yields.
Well, sounds like a fine mess we're in now, Danielle, and let's see what happens. Sounds like it's fairly predictable. Anyway, we'll let you go and rest your voice. Check out Danielle over at jugglingdynamite.com and her regular commentary and questions, comments, or anything else. Send us an email, kl@carrylutz.com. That's kl@carrylutz.com. Check out our site, financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Danielle, feel better, and we'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
Thanks, Gary.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.